From KQED Public Radio, this is Capital Notes, our weekly look at California politics.
And grooming.
Anthony's been working on his hair in the studio here.
He's, work is probably
the wrong word. Did you say you needed a haircut?
Hair is probably the wrong word. I think mane at this point.
All right. Well, we will send you to the barber toot suite. I'm John Myers from KQED. That's Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly. I'll talk about why I'm indebted to Anthony later in the podcast. Payola?
I'd like to hear payoff. This one.
Well, I mean, based on last week's podcast, but well, we'll get to that because it's really not – that's not important. You know, we're not the story.
No.
The story is the story. So let's talk about what's been going on in politics. So we had three topics we're going to talk about today. The brouhaha over pay raises for staffers in the Assembly, the latest on the budget burrito campaign. I'm going to keep calling it that. And gubernatorial politics and the Democrats come into Sacramento.
Three and a half subjects.
What's the half?
Well, gubernatorial politics come to Sacramento.
Anyway. Yeah. We're tying it all in somehow. So let's talk about the brouhaha to start with. I mean, you might have been, do I give you credit? Were you the first person who wrote this story?
I think you could do that
accurately. A few news organizations kind of all wrote them beginning of the week about pay raises going to Assembly staffers. Why don't you explain a little bit more of that and then what happened?
Well, this was on Tuesday evening. The Speaker, Karen Bass, revealed that she had authorized 5% pay increases for a number of staffers, about 130 members of the Assembly staff, Democrats and Republicans.
Was the total amount about, what, $500,000?
About $550,000 worth annually. And, of course, this, when put in the context of the May 19th campaign, it was viewed as a major PR snafu. I mean, here we have legislative leaders going to voters, asking them to make hard decisions about controlling spending and raising taxes
State workers are taking furloughs. Programs have been cut.
Right, and now the appearance is, in spite of that, the Assembly is thumbing their nose at essentially at the voters and at the people of California and giving their workers raises. Now, the Speaker had her own justification for why she granted the raises, and these were the rank and file members. They were not senior staff, which is debatable. Perhaps we can talk about that if you'd like.
if you'd like, go ahead.
Well, there were some members of her staff who were making a lot of money who got some pay raises. So.
But before we do that, by comparison, the Senate did not offer any pay raises.
The Senate, in fact, has a salary freeze.
Okay. So just as a comparison from one chamber to the other.
Right.
So, all right. But so you were talking about the kinds of staffers that were getting them, whether they were mid to low-level staffers or high-ranking staffers. Find some mix of that, I guess you said, or
well,
something.
Bass,
like that?
Bass described the people who got the raise as rank and file staffers. Although some of the names who were on the list were anything but. I mean, they were, you know, some of the most well-known members and the most powerful members of the Assembly staff who received some of these pay increases.
So this turned. It probably didn't turn on a dime. It probably didn't turn fast enough, or it's hard to know. I mean, because the story started trickling out, on Tuesday?
Night. Yeah.
Actually, maybe it did. By Wednesday afternoon, she had canceled the pay raises. She held a press conference,
right.
Called us all in, said, you know, basically, I don't want this to distract from anything, so I'm going to cancel the pay raises.
Still not apologetic at all about the merits of the pay raises.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it was very unclear what message she was trying to send. I mean, I, you know, pesky reporter that I am, asked her that question directly. I said, are you canceling them because of the appearance and the distraction or because you actually believe it was the wrong thing to do? She kind of went through it both ways, which I actually took to be the former, that it's a distraction,
right.
That it's a PR problem.
And well, it is a PR problem. But the Speaker's point is that the Assembly as an organization has reduced its overall budget and that, in fact, they have lost positions on the Assembly staff and that they're doing more with less and that some of these people are now being asked to fill portions of jobs that are being left vacant. And so even though these workers have received a small pay increase, they're being asked to do more work, and that's why and it's still a cumulative savings to the Assembly.
Well, you know, a couple of things that I couldn't quite figure out, and I, you know, want to freely admit I wasn't covering the story. I was watching all the rest of you cover the story. But first of all, we should say Mike Vallines, the Republican leader, agreed with the decision. He had his own little quick Q&A with reporters, said he cut his own paycheck by 5% to show I'm in it with everybody kind of thing. But Vallines also said that the pay raises had started had basically been okayed back in the fall and kind of made it seem like there was like a six-month process before it all happened. So I'm kind of wondering, I don't know if that's how long it takes to make that happen, but right, the timing incredibly bad with a special election around the corner.
Right.
But I would argue even back in October and November, the timing would have been bad because that's when we were facing a huge budget deficit.
Sure.
With no solutions on the table.
Right.
So if it had come out then, it would have looked bad.
Right. And remember, this was the budget negotiation that went on through the Christmas holiday and through January. And, you know,
February,
this was – so, you know – they can quibble all they want about the details of the timing. I mean, the reality is that you step back and you take a look at the appearance of it, and it's a problem. And I think that Bass was smart enough to recognize that and reluctantly, I think, rescinded the raises. Now, whether those raises are going to be back in effect after the special election, we can talk about in May or June.
Yeah, I was going to say that wasn't really clear, not ever really answered, was it?
No. And I think that, you know, well, we'll see. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
More chapters to be written on that. And I think, you know, if nothing else, the moral of the story is perception does become reality if nowhere else. I mean, for almost everywhere, it seems like these days in life, but especially in politics.
And especially during campaign season.
Yeah.
And, you know, the messaging on these ballot initiatives, as we've discussed, is complicated enough. And this just adds to the complications.
Well, let's talk about the complexity of those six ballot measures, because just as we have been saying for week after week after week, making us look like we're really smart.
Or very repetitive.
Or repetitive. The campaign continues to split itself into smaller campaigns.
Tacos even, instead of burritos,
yeah,
if you will.
Although the flour tortilla of the burrito is still there. I mean, the campaign led by the governor and his allies is still pushing all six. But below that has become a not quite a free-for-all, but a whole bunch of cast of characters of people for and against the rest of them. And we saw more of that this week.
Yeah, the build-your-own burrito, is that maybe, perhaps? we saw some money come from the service employees. They put $1 million into the initiatives, and they split it. The State Council of SEIU put $500,000 against Proposition 1A, the spending
constraint. Yes.
Okay. Spending constraint.
I'll explain why I'm calling it that in a moment, but yes, go ahead.
And another $500,000 to the Yes on 1C, the lottery modernization measure. Local 1000, the state employee local union of SEIU, gave $300,000 to the Yes on 1C. So SEIU total has given thus far about $1.3 million. $800,000 has gone to Yes on 1C and $500,000 to No on 1A.
But the local chapter, the state employee chapter of SEIU, still has not weighed in on 1A, right?
No, and I'm sure that apropos of nothing, right, they do they have a new state contract that needs to be ratified by the legislature and signed by the governor. That contract was up on Wednesday in the Assembly Appropriations Committee and was passed through on a voice vote. Will now go on to the Assembly floor. But I know that this is a political tightrope for Local 1000. I mean, they want to get their contract through. And I know that, you know, it's complicated enough that the state council has come out against Proposition 1A. They don't want to do anything that will anger the governor. I mean, the contract has moved through so far without any Republican votes, and they need 2/3 to get the contract off the Assembly floor. So,
have you been watching that one? I mean, there was some discussion in some corners that perhaps maybe even it wouldn't come up for a vote until after the election because it might cost the state money.
Right.
Or is that not the case?
There was
talk
that it would be moved to the suspense file in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. That did not happen yesterday. It was passed out by the chairman, Kevin DeLeon, on a voice vote and is eligible to be voted on as early as today.
But therein lies the issue, eligible to be voted on. I mean, it could sit waiting on the floor of the Assembly for a while, couldn't it?
It could.
Yeah.
So. It could. And as I've said thus far, there have been no Republicans who have gone on record supporting the contract.
Also in the money category for campaign for the campaign this week, we saw, proportionally speaking, the biggest pop of money for 1D and 1E, or against 1D and 1E, I should say, which is the transfer of money out of the childhood development programs is 1D and 1E is the temporary transfer for mental health services. Rob Reiner, who is a name we have not seen either on contribution reports or in political circles since he left the First Five Commission a few years ago after a whole brouhaha, Reiner gave money, a good chunk of change, against 1D, and other money came in for 1E as well.
And it should be noted, Reiner was the original proponent
of the measure that 1D seeks to amend.
Correct, to take money from. So, yeah. So Reiner is the original champion of what was Proposition 10, which would be undermined somewhat by Prop 1D.
Yeah. I alluded to the definition of the spending thingy a moment ago on Prop 1A because I was just going to quickly mention that I did a series of stories, two stories this week on for radio on the California Report about Prop 1A, one about the spending restraint and the reserve fund, and the second one about the whole issue of taxes. Now, the second one is kind of obvious to understand, the tax increase that we've been talking about that's been part of the political campaign. And we need to talk about the television ad in support of the measures in a moment. But on 1A specifically and the spending restraint, the reserve fund, what I think is really fascinating is that there are all of these layers of this that there's no way we'll ever get into a public conversation about these measures. I think they also show why some of the people fell out the way they did. And this is just hypothesizing on my point, but, you know, it's a podcast. Why not? Yeah. Let's take the spending restraint. The reason I kept calling it a restraint, I kept coming up with all these terms, and then you were very smart, Anthony. You didn't call it a cap from the beginning.
Correct. Correct about the latter, not the former.
Okay, good. it does seem difficult to call it a full cap because while it does stop spending above a certain level in most years, it does nothing to stop the legislature from increasing taxes and spending the money immediately.
Right.
Now, there's a long-term function about a tax increase and how it changes the revenue formula. But if the legislature wanted to spend more money immediately, they could raise taxes. That's a way around it. The anti-tax groups call that a huge loophole. I think the term huge is a little probably boisterous because it's not easy to pass taxes. It takes a two-thirds vote.
For now, yes.
But therein lies why I think one reason why Democrats, maybe Democratic leaders, have found a way that they're willing to put 1A up for a vote because they are actively working to get rid of the two-thirds vote. Or they're actively working on ways to raise taxes without a two-thirds vote.
Well, and both easier said than done. I mean, we've seen proposals to lower the vote threshold to raise taxes before. It didn't go so well. The voters didn't like that very much. So Democrats will try again. There's been the California Teachers Association, I believe. Is it CTA that has the initiative that's on the streets gathering signatures?
Okay.
Somebody does. And it has
somebody will call you and tell you.
Has a lot of legislative champions as well within the Democratic caucus. But it's tough. It's a hard sell.
And the other part of 1A, the reserve fund, you know, calling it a rainy day fund is again interesting when you look at the language. Only half of the money really would be set aside for bad times, and even right. Then that money is not terribly easy to get out. The other half is set aside if 1B passes, the school supplemental money one, is set aside completely for education, and
right.
It would have to be paid every year. It's not really even in a reserve. I mean, you may technically call it in a reserve, but it's almost like a pass-through. It's a take it out of the general fund. Oh, look, it's in a reserve. Turn around and write the check to education.
Schools have first dibs on at least half of that reserve money.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was unclear to me, and maybe this was revealed in your reporting.
You mean you didn't listen?
No, that's not what I mean. It was unclear to me. But maybe the part that didn't make it into your wonderful stories this week, which I listened to, thank you very much.
I was going to say, you've already been very complimentary of me, so, but we'll, anyway.
Anyway, is whether or not the money that schools would receive from that reserve fund is only this $8 billion or so that's in Proposition 1B, or if it's any ongoing general fund debt to schools in the future? This is probably way too technical for this podcast.
It might be too technical for the podcast, but not too technical for me, because I just finished writing the Prop 1B version that'll air on the California Report Monday morning. So listen to – go to californiareport.org. I think the answer to that question is when you look at the money in the reserve, which can only be spent for education if 1B passes, it is a it's for 5 or 6 years, right, about $1.5 billion a year. That money is added to the base level of school funding, which therefore increases the Prop 98 commitment. The Ledge Analyst Office says they think, though, that that's probably a blip or some other kind of term, and that in the long, long run, the Prop 98 target is probably close to where it was before all this happened. But effectively what it does is it gives the state a slightly more favorable amount of time to start giving that money to schools, and it doesn't allow the state to suspend those payments.
Right.
And then it increases the guarantee for a while, and then things probably go back.
So in some ways it's a better deal for the schools than what they would get under current law, because
that they don't get it as fast. I think if it was a maintenance factor, and yes, we have lost you, wonk friends. The wonks are here. Everybody else
both
has turned off and gone and had a beer.
Yes.
I think if it was a maintenance factor, they might actually start getting the money back sooner. This makes them wait until 2011, but it's absolute guaranteed they'll get it. There's no way to suspend the $1.5 billion if 1B and A pass.
Okay.
So there you go.
There it is.
So if that didn't lose you, stay tuned to public radio. I'm going to tell all of you.
Let's move on to John Garamendi.
Let's move on to some real just politics.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go to politics. So the race for governor changed this week.
Yes.
You said it. We talked about it last week that it was probably going to happen. You had it in the skinny, and it came true. John Garamendi, lieutenant governor, says he's no longer running for governor. He will run for Congress in the 10th district, the seat being vacated by Ellen Talcher, who is going to work for the State Department for President Obama. And so not only that, but we get the little bombshell here on Thursday as we're taping this. Joan Buchanan has said it's clear she's going to run, the assembly member from the East Bay, which now means you've got Joan Buchanan, John Garamendi, and let's not forget Mark DeSaulnier, the state senator from Contra Costa County, who has wrapped up all the big endorsements.
Right.
A three-way complicated race.
In a special election, nobody knows who's going to turn out. And a lot of unhappy people around. Joan Buchanan was elected in 2008 with the help from a lot of labor money.
2008? That makes it sound like it was a long time ago. It was like five months ago. Yeah.
And Democrats spent – and their funders spent a lot of money to get her elected in what was a Republican seat. It was one of the three Democratic pickups.
Right. It was a very tight race.
And now she's leaving. And if somehow she gets elected to Congress, Democrats will lose that seat in a special election. Odds, I'm not even going to hedge. If it comes down to a special
You're just making a prediction.
That'll be a Republican pickup. So, and I think a lot of Democrats know that, and that's why they are not happy with their colleague, Joan Buchanan, for jumping into this race.
Okay. Now, at the risk of trying to be too analytical to a race that is way too fluid, it hasn't firmed up. And as a matter of fact, it's not even completely a race yet, because Congresswoman Talcher is still Congresswoman Talcher. She hasn't left the position. And so they expect her to be confirmed, I think, next month for the Obama position, in which case then things would kind of start to trigger.
The governor has a certain number of days to call
it. But let's just play it for a moment here, these three candidates. I would think that Buchanan getting in the race as well, just my gut reaction, might help Garamendi, because Garamendi has more name ID probably than anybody in the race because he's a lieutenant governor, in which case could that hurt DeSaulnier more even though he has all the endorsements?
Well, perhaps Garamendi getting into the race helps Buchanan, because you have
two men
fighting it out from and a woman from a different part of the district. So,
to replace a woman member of Congress.
Right.
So there could be gender politics. It could be
absolutely
name identity politics. Then there's the endorsement and money race, which DeSaulnier clearly was way out in front on that early in all of it.
Yeah, and it'll be an interesting test for Buchanan. I don't know what sort of fundraising prowess she has on her own. I mean, she was a project of of the caucus, of the Democratic caucus. And now these people are angry with her. They're, the people who funded her race last time are probably not going to fund this race. So it's going to be one of the things to watch is how the Buchanan campaign materializes and whether she can raise any money.
So Garamendi made this announcement on, I think, Tuesday of this week?
Wednesday.
How the week flies by.
Mushes together.
So you were only off in the fact that you said he was going to do it at the convention this weekend.
Running up to the convention. Well, maybe it was like, you know, we stepped on a bumblebee and changed history. He wanted to surprise everybody at the convention, but we got it out there and the chatter was so hot he just couldn't resist.
Okay. Hot shot. all right. Well, picking up on the parlor game we played last week about this, because I think it's worth playing just a short version of parlor game again. Should Garamendi, and we're being very, very presumptive here, that Lieutenant Governor Garamendi could win this race. But if he won the race and there'd be a vacancy in the office of Lieutenant Governor and the governor would get to appoint a Lieutenant Governor, and we played the game, and I'm going to pick on one person out there in the political blogosphere. John Fleischman of the Flash Report,
You're
Republican
just mad
blog.
He outranked you, Myers.
No, that's not what I'm mad about. But he had a little blurb today on Thursday about that Mike Vallines, the Republican leader in the assembly, could get appointed. And I think maybe thought he had theorized that. And you and I said it first here on the podcast.
So, yeah.
So there you go, Fleischman. but you and I were talking. Let's just quickly play parlor game here on that again. I threw out the crazy name of Abel Maldonado. And then you threw out Jeff Denham or something. And then we were like, well, could a Republican get through the confirmation process in both houses, which is how it'd have to work? And my query is, but yes, if you took an Abel Maldonado out of that seat on the Central Coast that probably leans Democratic, could you not get a Democrat in the Senate and tip the 2/3 balance over to where you need it?
I like it.
So that could work.
Thank Myers.
That could work.
Could work.
But a lot of things have to happen first, also known as John Garamendi would have to win the race. So
for starters,
yeah.
Yes.
So no disrespect to Mr. DeSaulnier or Ms. Buchanan. We just like to play the parlor game.
Yeah, the dominoes aren't as interesting if one of them wins. Although there are dominoes to be played.
There are dominoes to be played, because then you've got to have special elections in those. And I actually think, and then we'll stop, I guess, on that part. I actually think the DeSaulnier victory is a more complicated mess, a more complicated issue than a Buchanan victory, because that pushes you – the Republican caucus in the Senate is even more intractable, it seems, over a 2/3 vote on issues. So that would give you one more vote you'd have to get a budget approved in the Senate.
Well, until – but that's a pretty safe Democratic seat. I think even in the special, if DeSaulnier were to win and go on to Congress, that Democrats could probably hold on to that Senate seat.
It's
And it might very well be Joan Buchanan – filling that Senate seat. But again, I think the issue of the Buchanan Assembly seat and Assembly Democrats getting close to 2/3, I think that's a much more likely Republican pickup if it happens either with a Garamendi victory or a DeSaulnier victory.
Let's close the door on the parlor. And
do you have any sound effects back there on that big fancy board?
You're pretty good at sound effects just then. Though the one you just made sounded a little questionable. It could have been all kinds of things. So, all right, we've closed the parlor door. And let's just talk about the fact that, as we alluded to, Democrats are here in Sacramento this weekend for the annual State Democratic Party Convention.
Woohoo.
boy, look at the excitement from Anthony.
It's like Tom Slick. You ever watch Tom Slick?
Not too much. So clearly people are going to be watching candidates for governor. Gavin Newsom announced this week that he's running for governor, and he made it official, though he kind of took the exploratory, I guess, out of the title.
He tweeted it. Are you impressed?
Yes, I did, as from one Twitterer to another. Jerry Brown is still technically, I guess, exploratory, or maybe even not that. But anyway, he's going to be at the convention too. You know everybody's going to be watching Brown and Newsom. Antonio Villaraigosa, the mayor of Los Angeles, is not coming to the convention.
Canceled.
Canceled due to having to work on the city budget.
Spend more time with his family.
City budget crisis in Los Angeles. And then Garamendi, of course, has dropped out, so we won't talk about that. Dianne Feinstein's not showing up at the convention either, so there won't be that kind of backstory.
Isn't there anybody else we can get?
No, but it's people watching Newsom and Brown. Is that worth watching this weekend?
I don't know. How masochistic are you?
Depends.
it's another podcast. I don't know. It's there will be a little jockeying. It's early days yet. I mean, I think it's a victory for Newsom. He wants this to be a two candidate race so that he can make it a generational issue. And Newsom's life is a lot easier without Antonio Villaraigosa in the race. You know, Villaraigosa has not officially said he's running for governor. He would have a free shot at it, but he could hold on and wait for a U.S. Senate seat opening, perhaps in 2012 or 2016. Who knows? Maybe the governor will appoint him lieutenant governor. What do you think?
Hmm.
Probably not.
Odds are thin.
So that Schwarzenegger can run for mayor of Los Angeles.
Odds are thin. Odds are thin. The convention also is probably going to feature, I think, some squabbling about the special election. You've got a lot of grassroots folks in the Democratic Party who do not like these measures, especially the spending constraint of Prop 1A. And you've got the Speaker and the pro tem, Bass and Steinberg, who are pushing it. And so there's kind of a...
So what do you say? What's going to happen? No endorsement?
Clash there. I'd be surprised if there's an endorsement. What do you think?
I
think if they just go neutral, that's the safe thing for the party to do on those issues.
Yes.
And then there'll be a new party chair, John Burton, former pro tem, iconic, irascible John Burton becoming the new top guy at the party, and that'll happen too.
Four-letter descriptions to follow.
Yeah, every word out of his acceptance speech probably cannot be used on the podcast.
Probably not.
Yeah, we would have to even do bleeping, even on a podcast.
Oh, that's the Tom Slick thing again.
Good. I have to kind of let you do all of that now. If you listened to the podcast last week when we were talking about Capital Weekly's top 50 whatevers they are, now I can't even call them something big. Because I should just say top 50 people, and I even think that's disputable by what I'm about to say. I said, jokingly, where am I on the list?
And the answer was?
And Anthony made it, you know, made a funny joke, and we had a good time. Well, and then I'm in the other part of the list, and I'm feeling very like, you know, payola-ish here, like I've now owe you something. And
well, so. You know, you have my mailing address. You know how to find me.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I feel bad is the people below me, since I'm at 95.
Now you know where you stand, at least in my eyes.
And your hair is only...
Speaking of standing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you really do need a haircut. The more he runs his hands through his hair, he needs
Maine.
A haircut. Well, anyway, that was very exciting.
And very well deserved.
Well, thank you.
I may say.
And the Mutual Admiration Society ends there. That's it for this podcast. Tune in next week when we see what issues we can rehash again.
Compelling.
You're really. Boy, there's a teaser. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.